You probably feel like you meet a lot of marketers. Well, marketers meet an especially large number of marketers. We've got trade shows, we've got associations, we've got awards, and we tend to do a lot of networking. Well, one thing I've observed is that marketers and vendors tend to have unusual positions of leadership. Maybe you can identify with this. Guiding the client, directing a creative team, leading an audience, managing a project. And how about managing perception? Clearly, it all starts with effectively and positively leading ourselves.
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
I'm definitely excited to bring you this second episode of Spiral Marketing with our first amazing guest, professor, positive leadership expert, and all-around class act, Steve Gladys. There's tremendous value for everyone in this episode, and to commemorate, I recorded my father, Ralph Bohm, lifelong musician and orchestra teacher, to play Simple Gifts, an American folk song written in the 18th century by Joseph Brackett Jr. I hope you enjoy and absorb a lot of great insights.
Steve, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Carl. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Steve Gladys is a leadership thought leader, author, and George Mason University professor. He works at the SGLP, of which he's also the founder. He inspires leaders to become even better through executive coaching, leadership development, and motivational speaking.
Yeah, that's what we do. It's been a lot of fun. Been doing this for now 8 years. Prior to that, I was at the University of Virginia for 10 years. Been teaching at George Mason, actually, for 22 years. So it's kind of a culmination. This is my last hurrah. We sort of built a business based on a philosophy that everybody deserves to work for a good leader, and every leader deserves to know what good leadership is. So that's kind of the philosophy that drives the company, and I'm trying to affect as many leaders as I can at a time. I remember this great story about a starfish. There was a young kid walking on the shore. A thousand starfish had washed up on the sand, and he was throwing them in back in the water one at a time. An old man comes up to him and said, "What are you doing?" The kid says, I'm saving these starfishes. And the old man looked around. He says, "There's thousands of them around. You'll never get them all." The kid picked up one of the starfishes, threw it in the water, and it plunked in the water. He said, "Well, I saved that one anyway." And that's kind of how I see this in my swan song the next 10 or 15 years, as much time as I have left to be in this business, to keep throwing starfish back in the water. I mean, it's that's kind of what's driven me here in this last hurrah of my career.
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah.
That's cool. And I should also say that, Steve, you and I work in the same building part of the week. And
true.
You know, we've had lunch a couple times, and it's a lot of fun. I've read a couple of your books, including...
You're the guy.
Yeah, that was me. Of course, wanted to talk to you about positive leadership today, but the Coach Approach is another book that I've picked up of yours, and I knew quickly that I wanted to try and talk to you and get you on the podcast, because I really appreciate your style of how it's just very apparent how much research you put into your books, into your work, and you talk about how you want to give a quick value to anybody who's reading, and I think that comes off and comes through in spades, really.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm dyslexic, and as a writer, most people, and also a little ADHD, but mostly dyslexic more than anything else. And so as a result, people think it's easy to write, and it's very easy for me to write, but I have to edit over and over again. And I found that one of my friends told me one day, this is my coach, said to me, "Well, the reason you write is to figure out what you're thinking." And it sort of stunned me. I said, "Well, yeah, that's exactly what it is." So as I'm learning, as I'm writing, as I'm researching, I'm really doing it to teach people what I've learned. And I have this sort of urgency to teach. That's what I call it. When I read something new, like, for example, I taught a class today with a bunch of executives, and I had to tell them about this new thing that I found out about deception. And we now know there are certain giveaways of deception that's just been proven. And I had to teach that to them because I said, you really need to know this in your business. But that's the way I write and read and research all based on this concept that I see myself as a teacher and as a coach. And fueling that is this need to research and be up on what's going on. Just had a client in my office who was going through a lot of change management stuff. I said, well, have you read John Cotter's research? No. I said, you need to research. You need to read this. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. This guy spent years figuring out how to make change management work. Why would you want to kill yourself without reading the research first? Which I find is really a problem, not only for graduate students or undergraduates, but it's a problem for business guys. Still go out and spend a lot of money on something that somebody's researched for years and says, can tell them this is the process you need. There are the 8 steps. And literally, John Cotter has 8 steps for change management. I mean, you know, you're probably not going to do better than his 25 years of research and teaching at Harvard, I would think. So I try to infuse that into businesses.
There's been a recurring quote that comes up where if you're really ready for a teacher, then they'll show up.
One will appear. That's the old, the Buddhist thing that when the teacher appears when the student is ready.
And there's plenty of books for folks to go out there and
read
if they're just willing to find the teacher.
I would just tell people that, you know, before you would spend any amount of money, a significant amount of money, do some research, do a poor man's literature search, go on Google, go to Google Scholar, just put it in there and say, look, I'm having trouble with change. Put it in there. I actually recommend that people, a couple of tricks that I use. One is I go into Google Scholar, and then I hit images. And sometimes some of these models are already out there for you. I mean, they're there. Just cut and paste. Or I'll do a video. I'll do a YouTube video, a 4 or 5 minute YouTube video where an expert explains it, and I kind of get the concept and I dig deeper. People spend way too much time either avoiding doing research or doing the wrong kind of research or spending way too much time at it. It doesn't have to be difficult. You just have to understand the concept and then you can start digging deeper.
Well, when I get into positive leadership, yeah, sure. I'd love to hear in your words how you define positive leadership.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me describe the difference between happiness and positivity, because I think that's useful, because a lot of people use the two terms together, and they're not really the same thing, but they're very closely related. So think of positivity as, think of the stock market every day. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down all during the day. That's how happiness works. You have happy moments, you have sad moments, you have angry moments. But think of it as a stock market flickering up and down all day long. That over a period of time, all those happiness moments create a vector. So look at the stock market trend for the last 20 or 30 years, and you'll see a vector. That vector is either going north or south. Fortunately, the stock market over 30, 40 years has been north. And I'm praying that stays that way through my retirement. But it has, you know, if you think of the day-to-day ups and downs as happiness and happiness, positive things happening, negative things happening as happiness, think of the trend as being positivity. So positivity can either be pointed north, or it could be pointed south toward negativity. But happiness is the others day to day happen. You may have had 20 things happen today. They're either positive or negative. Those are the sort of I see as the happiness trends, and positivity as a long-term trend. And positive leaders are people who are in for the long term. They're pushing people toward positivity on a day-to-day basis, day in and day out, month in and month out, year in and year out. People, most of us have worked either for bosses that are negative or positive. It's very rare that you get a guy that's neutral. And if you've ever worked for somebody who's positive, he pushes you toward to being the best person you can be. They tend to push you toward taking chances. They give you the sense of respect. They give you a sense of accomplishment. They're less critical and more supportive. And they're the kind of people that push you to take on challenges that you didn't think you could. Do by creating an atmosphere that says it's okay to fail, it's okay to try it, it's okay to not do well at it, to learn from it and move on. So there are natural ups and downs, but positive leaders tend to push people toward that positive vector. So again, think of positivity and happiness and positivity as being like day-to-day weather is one thing, climate is a trend. So Miami's warmer, Boston's colder, you know. Think of them in those terms and you get a better sense of what positive leadership is. It's moving people on a positive vector over a period of time.
Interesting. I like how they're the force moving people towards it. That's an interesting visual and insight.
Yeah, for leadership, it's about creating the atmosphere, literally, that it's okay to make mistakes, that it's okay to try. In fact, I'm writing a book right now on creativity and innovation. And one of the things that we know you have to have is you have to have safety. It has to be safe to fail. You have to actually challenge people to fail. Fail fast, but learn from it and pivot, move into a different direction. I mean, it's like you come up with a business model. 9/10 of the business models that people come up with never work. So you have to change. You have to add things. I remember when I started, I had to change from consulting to coaching because I didn't like consulting all that much. I thought I would, but I didn't. And I ended up adding motivational speaking, which I ended up loving. And so you add, you subtract, you pivot, you do those kinds of things because you learn. A null hypothesis is when you do research and you prove that it doesn't work. But it's as valuable to find out what doesn't work as what does work. So leaders that create that safe space and that allow people to try and try and try again are the guys that really have the innovative companies happen. I mean, that's what Google does. Google allows 20% of its time to its engineers to do research on whatever they want. And Google Mail, Google Apps, Google Maps, all that stuff came from that 20%. Most of that stuff came from that 20% time. Didn't come from there. People actually, working on that as a job. It was the stuff they wanted to do. So when you Google Docs, all that stuff came up. Gmail came up from people experimenting and failing and trying this and saying, gee, this really works. And this didn't work. So it's interesting, it's just, you create the atmosphere and it happens.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
But fail fast. I think that's something I've heard in Google literature before, of where they talk about themselves, that's something they want to do, fail fast.
What they mean by that is, if you go back into the 1999, the tech boom, I was in the middle of that at UVA. People were building these elaborate models, these elaborate software models, these websites. They were putting millions of dollars, and they were getting all kinds of investment because everybody wanted to get rich quick. It was, I call, the gold rush fever kind of thing. Just like the old 1849, let's go make $1 million. So people invested tons of money in these software before they ever knew anybody that wanted them. And then they would launch these things, and they would be big turds. I mean, they wouldn't go anywhere. What we're doing now is that there's a movement now in business which is called Lean Startup. It's called a lot of things, but it's basically instead of putting out this huge website, put up a bunch of pages, and see which page people hit, and then develop that one. Rather than, a lot of times they'll put up a page that just goes to that. You'll click on it, and they'll count the hits, and they'll start to develop the infrastructure behind that before they're able to do anything else because they know what page you're hitting. So it's like don't divide. You put up five pages, three pages people are hitting. Get rid of the other two. Just develop those three pages.
Right.
It's really a soft pivot in that direction. There's a guy named Reese that's done a book called Lean Startup. There are a bunch of people in that mode right now. But it's really about staying positive and not getting beat down by a failure. Fail often, fail fast. Fail smart.
That's great. Yeah. And the culture, creating that culture of safety and an environment of safety, that reminds me of the research that you pulled where, and maybe you could speak to this more clearly, where if somebody puts their thought out there, they need, is it 3-to-1 positive reinforcement, something like that?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting, interesting quote. There's a bunch of research was done by a guy named Marcel Lasada. And Lasada actually did it with Business Spine. He actually watched meetings taking place, and he counted, very tedious research, they counted the number of interactions with people and then had them assess their relationships. And he found that there are three statistics. There's a statistic of one positive, for every one positive interaction, to every one negative interaction, that you would think that's a balanced relationship. In fact, Lasada found that's a relationship that's slowly but surely headed for divorce court. Because what he found out in the research was that negative comments, and I just rediscovered this morning with a class, negative comments outweigh positive by 2-to-1. So when people see a report card that kid gets 4 A's and a C, parents go right to the C and say, what happened here? They don't go to the 4 A's and say, gee, you did a great job in these, and this is probably going to get you MIT. They're worried about the set of the quantum mechanics and calculus to get A's, and they're worried about the C he got in Spanish. And they tend to divert the kid into getting a B or an A in Spanish, but then his other grades drop.
So puts them on the defensive.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, what are we going to do about the C rather than the 4 A's is what's going to get him into MIT, not the C in Spanish. But, and I, whether it's Spanish or history or whatever. But Losada found that Losada's line is 3-1. If you have 3 positives to every 1 negative, you have a vector that's moving north. You have a positivity vector that's moving northward. If you can keep it in that. And once you learn those ratios, it kind of makes you think twice the next time you say something to somebody else. And so today, an interesting situation. I asked a bunch of students to rate their former bosses, either a current or previous boss, on this trust scale. I wrote a book on trust as well, and I had them rate. And then I asked them, I said, how many of you rated bosses that were good bosses? And about a third of the class did that, but two-thirds of the class rated bad bosses. And I said to them, why did you pick a bad boss? And all of them said, pick the bad boss because he had much more impact on me in a negative way than the positive bosses did in a positive way. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
Really sad. But
that's a meaningful insight there.
It's like, wow, yeah. I mean, I always love it when surprises. I mean, I actually thought more of them would do it on a good boss. Most of them, two-thirds of them, did it on a bad boss. So I had to ask that question. So now I want to research that a little bit more. You know, I mean, well, is that something that people will do more frequently when you give them this opportunity? My guess is, my hypothesis would be, yeah, that they, and they were very quick to say that that these bosses had lasting effects on them. And they to this day still feel that. And this is 10 years ago that things like this happened.
Interesting. I guess trauma is less fleeting than a positive experience.
That's exactly it. Think of it as bosses can inflict post-traumatic stress on people. I mean, really, when you think about it, I mean, if you've ever had a crappy boss, I've been asked the question in the past, how did you ever get involved in this positive research? My story goes back probably, gosh, I think now I hate to say this, but it's like 30 years. It goes back to 1984, roughly. I worked for a guy named Phil. I was the head of counterterrorism for the FBI in Washington, D.C. It's a pretty hairy job. It was a pretty cool job. I was an FBI agent at the time. And I worked for a guy named Phil. And Phil was the kind of guy that trusted everybody. And because Phil trusted everybody, everybody trusted him. And we trusted each other. All the people who worked from all our peers. I was a supervisor of a squad. And there were 15 or other folks like me. But his trust was a contagion that went down in the organization in such a way that we all sort of caught it. Because leaders create emotional contagion, either good or bad. Phil got promoted, moved out, and in walked Bill. And we were all praying that we'd get somebody even close to as good as Phil. But we all understood regression to the mean, which means that if you win the Super Bowl and get a great boss one year, you're probably not going to win the Super Bowl two times in a row. And sure enough, that happened. Bill came in. He was a terrible boss. He didn't trust anybody. He questioned everything. It was kind of the guy that after you got through talking to him, he couldn't remember your name because we wonder if you were telling the truth about your own name. He was that kind of a guy. Distrusted everybody and destroyed the organization within 6 months. Within 3 months, most of the people who had options left. That's the difference. And when I saw the difference between a positive boss and a negative boss, that stuck with me for 30 years. And I think that's what was at the very basis of me writing this book. I started to discover this thing called positive leadership, positivity, negativity. And I started to think of these guys, and I thought, you know what? I don't want anybody else to ever suffer. If I can prevent it, I don't want anybody else to suffer from that kind of leadership. And so I decided that I'd write this book. And that was really at the core of writing this book. And I tell that story in more detail, but I tell that story to classes when I teach, is what a difference the two guys made in the organization. And, I'd say everybody deserves to work for a positive boss, a good boss, and every boss needs to know what good leadership is. And they don't. I mean, there are a lot of people who learn. If you're abused as a child, okay, the chances of you abusing a child are pretty high. It's a sad statistic, but it's true. If you're bullied as a child, the chances of you bullying somebody else, pretty high. In other words, this stuff is sort of learn by learn behavior. So what about if you are treated positive by a boss and you would, so that you would treat other people positive? The problem is a lot of people have been, have worked for abused bosses who have abused them. And what that does is it creates a chain of abuse. And people think it's normal to yell at people in a meeting. That's like, it's a normal thing. That's nuts. And so, but it's, if it's learned, it seems like it's normal to you.
Becomes systemic within the organization.
So they don't, so the people don't know that yelling is a bad thing and that it really scars people terribly. Makes you unconfident about yourself, makes you second guess yourself, the opposite of what you want. And if you ask people the best bosses they ever had, they'll tell you they're the most positive bosses, without a doubt. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Was there a quote that sticks with you through your research about positive leadership?
It came years and years before. It was by a guy, one of our guys, Ansel Sparks, used to quote used a Zig Ziglar quote all the time at the FBI Academy. He used to teach at the FBI Academy, and it's the best quote I know. And it goes like this: attitude, not aptitude, will determine your altitude. Attitude, not aptitude, will determine your altitude. So think of the people in your life that have done well. Oftentimes, they're the people that have the best attitudes. It's not how smart you are. In fact, there's a second quote that I would tag on to that was from Teddy Roosevelt. He said, people don't care what you know until they know that you care. And that's a kind of a neat quote.
Those are both great quotes.
You may have to, think about it. Everybody wants to be the smartest guy in the room. The smartest guys in the room don't make the best leaders. In fact, all the research done on the CEOs show that they're usually the BC students, not the A students, because they learn how to navigate social systems to make up for the lack of being a quant, a 4-0. 4-0s, a lot of these 4-0s are, I won't say all of them, but many people who are that smart oftentimes lack a certain amount of social savoir-faire. When you run a company, you not only have to be smart, you have to be able to get along with people. You have to be able to relate and communicate with people. It's not how smart you are. Being smart is kind of a given. There's a plateau of what a certain level you have to have. But once you're in that space, I was listening to Dan Goleman. He was talking at Google, and he was talking about all those guys at Google. He said, you guys are all at this 130, 140 IQ. He said, you're all smart. He said, but the difference between those of you who become leaders is those guys have social skills. You're not getting to play in the big leagues at Google unless you have social skills. Because everybody's got the smarts. Everybody can program in Java and blah, blah, blah. And everybody can, do math calculations or whatever the hell they do. But at the top levels, the people who get promoted are the people with the social skills. They have baseline, high IQs, but they also have this other element called social, as he calls it, a more social-emotional intelligence.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really big factor. In fact, when you get to a certain point in leadership and it's at mid-level to upper management, 75% of your success rate comes not from your skill set, but from your emotional skill set. It's a reverse of what happened in the beginning of your life. In the beginning, you get rated on your skills and very little on anything else other than that. What happens is it flips when you have all these employees now that you're dealing with and all this stuff that you're, all this business development you're dealing with. Now it's 75% of your rating comes from the social skills and the emotional skills, not from the programming skills or marketing skills, not the stuff you learned in school. That reverses when you become a leader.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's great.
So taking more marketing classes probably is not going to get you, when you get to higher levels, not going to make you promotable to CEO as much as taking classes on leadership and emotional intelligence, stuff like that.
Right. Working on personal development,
things
like that. Interesting. Well, you certainly sound like you're still very passionate about the subject.
And
I was going to ask you what keeps you passionate, and I keep thinking about your starfish story.
Keeps me going. I mean, I just keep thinking, well, there's another one. Throw them in. Every time I teach a class, I teach a bunch of classes at Georgia Mason, mostly for executive development kinds of classes for usually mid-level leaders, and I just get such a thrill when they come up and say, "Geez, I just learned so many things today." Today I did a class on influence. I'm writing a book on influence and persuasion. I've been studying teaching that for years and years. And I just decided to pull an outline together. I did it in about 2 weeks. I pulled an outline together, and I gave a lecture today, a four-hour lecture on this, all the stuff I've learned over the years about influence. And a couple of came up after the class, and they said, God, that was just great stuff. It's not an ego thing that they – I'm just happy that they got the information that took me 20 years to figure out. They got it in 20 minutes – or not 20 minutes, 3 hours, but it, you know, 4 hours, whatever it was. But I've been collecting that stuff for – you know, 25 years now, maybe more than that now. I mean, I'm through this. I reviewed a book 25 years ago that's now in like in its third or fourth edition, you know, and so this guy's republished it four times now, you know.
Wow.
So it's kind of fun. A lot of fun.
Yeah, you mentioned a book you're writing on influence and negotiation and creativity and innovation. You're working on two books at the moment?
Yeah, well, yeah, I finished research on one. And I'm starting the research on the second one. Although, to be honest with you, I could really write the second book faster because I've been researching that book for 25 years. I've really got it down. It's not that hard. But I wanted the book that took me a longer time was this Creativity and Innovation book, which I've been toying with the last year or year and a half. And the way I do it is kind of sneaky. What I do is I read books on a particular topic, and I usually focus on a topic for a year, not completely, not 100%, but probably 70-80% of the books I read are on a particular topic. And then at the end of the year, I review those books and put them on my blog twice a month. And at the end of the year, I then compile them and then sort them, and then I write a book on it. So, because most of the research is done by then. I figure I have about 25 hours per book. And it's just a lot of work. So you do two a month, that's 50 hours of work a month of research.
Per month, yeah.
Per month. So it's a grind, but I love it because I get up in the morning, I do my reading, and I write later in the day, and I have a kind of a routine that keeps me producing these things. And what I found is the research keeps me fresh, keeps me on top of stuff. And so when my clients come in, they say, oh, you know, we have trouble with this guy because I think he's a bit of a narcissist. I go, hey, here's a good article for you. Here's a review we did of a book on how to handle difficult personalities. And they're 2-page summaries that people can read like that. They don't have to spend 25 hours condensing them. You can just read them. And there are plenty of services out there. I'm not by no means unique. Plenty of summary book services out there. I do the summaries for me. And then I hope that they help my clients. And they usually do. And I send them out, the summaries out to people. I post them on the thing. And then you know, I blog on them and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah, well, you're very generous with your knowledge. And that definitely comes off in your books as well.
Yeah. No, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this. There's my wife and I just got back from Mary Washington. We're on the University of Mary Washington. And we, my wife graduated from UCSD. Her mother was 98 years old. And we're on a fundraising committee to raise $50 million for the school. And I gave them a quote. I found this quote and I sent it to the head of development. I'll probably butcher it a little bit here, but basically it says this. It said, a society is healthy when old men, and parentheses, and old women. This was done by an old Greek guy, so he used his men. A society is healthy when old men and women are willing to plant trees whose shade under which they will never rest. And so it's kind of, when you think of it, the idea of aging is about preparing guys like you and my daughter. I mean, you know, I've got kids your age, you know, I've got a 40-year-old daughter and a 32-year-old daughter. I'm trying to plant trees now for leaders that will help them when they become heads of corporations or whatever they're going to do, or heads of nonprofits, that I'm never going to see happen. I mean, most of the people I'm working with, I'm probably not going to, you know, I'm not going to be like Martin Luther King, so I may not be there with you when you get to that land, you know? And I'm not, I don't propose to even be anywhere in the same league as a Martin Luther King, but it's the idea of old men. The responsibility of elders, I think, in a society is to plant trees that will create shade for the future, for my grandkids, for my kids. You know, that's the deal. And you, as you get older, it's very natural to start thinking that way. Everybody sort of, I think, gets there at one point or other. They're thinking about this thing continuing on. So that's really what drives what I do, from a philanthropy standpoint and from a just an educational standpoint. I don't think you own this money that you got. I think all we're doing is renting this stuff. It's a monopoly game at the end. You put it all back in the box and somebody else gets to play, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm not going to my wife will get the money maybe, but and so we've dedicated a lot of our 25% of our wealth. We try to give back every year. We get involved in a number of campaigns, and we try to be smart about it. But that's the, I think giving stuff is what leaders is. That's what a leader's supposed to do. You gotta, I try to practice some of the stuff that's in this book on leadership, on positive leadership. There's a lot of good techniques in here. I just want to, if I have a moment, to tell you about one of the, there's like 100 of these things there, but one that was, I think, is the most powerful thing I've ever read in my life. It was discovered by a guy named Marty Seligman. Mark Seligman's a head of the psychology up in the University of Pennsylvania. He found this out, that when they dealt with depressed patients, that if every night before they went to bed, they wrote down three things that went well a day, that within 15 days, they'd start to see a difference, and they did. So I tell all my clients, all my friends, all my relatives, start keeping a journal at night. I keep a little pad, a little CVS ring binder notebook up in my medicine cabinet, eye level, right on top of which is my Lipitor that I have to take every night, keep my heart strong. So I take it down, I take my little pill, and at the same time, I write down three things. I've been doing this for 2 years now, and my life has had what I would call a slow motion miracle. I mean, just stuff's happened that I can't account for any other way than that. And what happens, and what we think happens, and what we can safely say no happens now, is that by doing this every night before you go to bed, it reframes your brain to start looking for the things that you're grateful for, not the things that are going bad. If I told you to look for all the bad stuff in this room, you could find bad things, I guess, a little dirt here, it's smudge there. But this reframes your brain so you start to pick up, you actually start to become a filter for good stuff and grateful for the stuff you have.
That's great. That's really helpful, actionable. Yeah. Is there a leader that you really admire, a positive leader that you really admire?
Well, one guy that I have done a lot of work with and I like a lot is Adrian Chapman. Adrian's at he's the president of Washington Gas. He's not the CEO, but he's the president. So he runs their utility. Adrian's not only a positive guy, he's a very decent guy. He's honest. He's very straightforward. He's very thoughtful. And he's always about developing his people. And he's a kind guy. I've never seen him get mad. I've seen him get upset like anybody would, but not mad. He's not a screamer. He doesn't get crazy. He doesn't, when people fail, he wants to know what's going on, but he's not going to chop their heads off. And he's my idea of a really great boss. And if you talk to any of his direct reports, and I have, and I know them, and I've worked with a number of them, they all have undying respect for this guy because of that. I think that there's a thing that's called the trust triangle. And the trust triangle has three pieces to it. Character. So if you have to have a good character, you have to be honest, straightforward, and decent. You have to have character that people can depend on, number one. Number two, you need to be competent at what you do. You need to know your business. You don't have to be the smartest guy in the room, but you have to know the business. So doctors should be leading doctors, and lawyers ought to be running law firms. Adrian has great character. He knows the business. He's been through that business over 30 years. He knows it. But the last part of the triangle is caring. So the three C's: character, competence, and caring. People have to know that. You have to know that you care about them. And I think he is that kind of a guy. I've seen him work with people. I've talked to people about him, and they all think he cares about him. And I know from him that he does. So he'd be my ideal guy for a candidate. I would have no trouble working for him. And the biggest test for that is, would you recommend your son or daughter work for somebody? That's the big test of a positive leader. If the answer is, yeah, I'd have him work for them. There's people that I've worked with, clients that I've worked with in the past, that quite frankly, I respected, but I'm not sure I would want my daughter to work for them.
Interesting.
Yeah. Not many, but there are a few. Yeah.
What piece of advice would you give somebody to keep them growing well in positive leadership?
I would say practice positive activities, and there are several of them. One is keep the journal at night. That's the first thing I would say. If you did nothing else but that, that would change the way you see the world. There are a couple of other things you can do. One is at the beginning of every morning, write an optimism projection. for the day. So I was optimistic that I was going to, I had three things going on today, and I was optimistic that they'd go well, and I wrote them down. So it's almost like a sandwich. I have one thing at the beginning, one thing in the end. Kindness is actually a very interesting proposition. It's a positive, it's called a positive, these are called positive emotions. There are 10 of them that they've identified. But kindness is another one. And once a week, I recommend to people, based on some heavy-duty research in this area, that you do three or four things once a week. And for me, it's Wednesday, so it'll be tomorrow. I'll send myself an email tonight about what four or five things I want to do. And so I've done all sorts of things, like bought somebody coffee behind me in a coffee shop without telling them that I'd done it. Just the woman would just say, "Hey, somebody before you just bought a cup of coffee." Or I've left messages from the guys that work on my car, so thanking them for working on the car. Somebody that I wouldn't even meet. I have a BMW, never get to meet the guy that works on the car. And I've gotten some great feedback from their managers saying how much that helped them. I've sent flowers to my doctor's receptionist. I've sent emails to my dentist saying how much I appreciate his taking care of my teeth and my family's teeth for so many years. And it changes your relationship. It's really amazing. It's a simple thing, like an email saying to your uncle or something, like how much you appreciate what he did for you over the years. It breeds such incredible feedback that it not only helps you, but it helps you. So actually practicing a lot of this stuff on a day-to-day basis, but becoming very intentional about it. That's why I keep a notebook. I have one notebook at my reading stand in the study that I have. It's actually in a small bedroom where the grandkids come and sleep when I don't have it, or when they come, rather, and one that I keep in the medicine cabinet. So it triggers it. One in the morning I do in the morning, and one at night. I'm at those two places. So I'm very intentional about that. It's not, well, I'll keep it. No, they're there, and I do them every day and pretty regularly. I mean, just I do them every day. I take them with me on trips. But being intentional is pretty important.
Intentional positive routines at the beginning, yeah, and at the end, and it sets a tone that tends to stick more throughout your day as you go on.
Yeah, because it programs your brain. Yeah, so if I said to you, what kind of goal would you like to set in your life? So, well, I'd like to get healthy. Would you write that down every day? I'm going to eat better. So if you write it down every day, after a while, it starts to work on your head. So that when you're faced with a healthy or unhealthy choice, you're more likely to go healthy than you would have had you not done that, because you tend to live into this thing. Your brain has a thing called a switch of commitment consistency, that once you write it down, you tend to get committed. That's why goals are so important for organizations. Because if you write down a goal, the chances of you being more committed to it are much higher. I mean, we know that. We there's enough research out there to say we know that's true. So when anybody that says, let's have some annual goals and let's write those goals down and let's measure those goals on a regular basis, he's more likely to get the productivity out of people, and especially when the person setting those goals really believes in them and thinks they're reasonable, not crazy. I mean, some people set crazy goals. They're like, go, 300%, that's nuts, but what if you find a reasonable goal, everybody says, that's really it's a goal we have to reach, but I think we can reach it. You tend to reach those goals.
If something gets written down, it's more likely to get done. Yeah. If something gets measured, then it tends to grow.
That's really what coaching is all about. In coaching, we get people every month, and we meet them twice a month, to commit to doing one or two things between now and the next time, based on solving a particular problem that they have and that they have through our coaching process, they've identified as potential steps to solve that problem. Not me. They identify them. I help them through questions identify those steps. But then I'll say, what do you want to be held accountable for? And they'll say, well, I could do this or I could do that. Okay, we'll talk about it next time. And so I give them a little email saying, we talked about these things. You said you'd do one and two. Here's them. And we'll talk about it next time. So it's in the file. When they come in, I say, hey, how's it going with one and two? And it's amazing how many things get done between 24 and 48 hours before they meet the next time with me.
So they do their homework.
Yeah, accountability. It's like the term papers do, right? You said you'd want to be accountable, and there's somebody on the other end of this is going to ask you about that. It's like you say you're going to get fit on January 1st, and you cold, windy day, rainy, you roll over. But if your neighbor, you've agreed with your neighbor, you're going to work out together, and he's knocking on the door, knock, 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 you're going to probably get up and go run. Or go whatever. Yeah, it's sort of accountability is important.
How about teams? What can teams do to get positive, more positive?
That's interesting. One of the things you can do is start every meeting with a positive. This is what there's a thing called framing. And one of the ways that I teach this to teams is start every meeting on a positive note and end it on a positive note. So here's how you can do it. You say, let's go around and talk about one thing that's going on in your life right now that's great. And just go around the table and let people talk about it. What that does is it sets the happiness level high. It relaxes people because they're all revealing to each other. And it sets a positive tone for people so that just the opposite happens. Most people start, let's go with the financials. I mean, that's like, it's like driving it right into the ground, So start it high and end it high. And one of the ways to end it, I always end meetings with clients, is tell me one thing of value you got out of today's meeting. And you'd be surprised what people say. I'm always surprised at what they say because it's so varied. It's never always the same. Well, I got the same as Joe. I got the same. It's always different because people are filtering through a different process. But if they walk away, if they started high and they ended on a what they got out of value out of meeting, you'd be surprised at how that raises the level of the meeting. I mean, that's just two simple techniques that you can use. Holding each other accountable. Peer coaching is another way of raising the level I teach teams how to coach each other, and they pair off and actually coach. It's cheaper. You don't need a coach. You just need a coach to coordinate the effort. But the teams can actually do the coaching of each other. And in fact, we found that really builds relationships. It become far more intimate. I did a workshop for a company and paired off two people who I did not know did not like each other. I didn't know that ahead of time. I just did it by mistake. I just said, you two. And I found out what somebody came up to me and said, gee, did you know you paired up these two? They don't like each other. Within 6 months, those two not only liked each other, but their groups were working better. They were more productive. And they had sustained it longer than anybody else because they had grown to like each other.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's powerful. I'm sure that there will be listeners who have to deal with people that they don't like dealing with necessarily, and to use some of these tactics to improve those relationships and even just to improve the interactions within those relationships, I think it's really powerful.
Yeah, I was amazed by it. I found out it after the fact. I said, oops, I wish I hadn't have done that. I said, no, it's actually working. So now I'm thinking, well, maybe that's a technique to try and test and see how that works. See if it works regularly. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but certainly worked in that time.
That sounds good.
In that case, yeah.
From your experience, do you know if leaders know if they're being positive or not?
No, they don't. I don't. So when I give these, I give a lot of speeches now. I do probably do 40 or 50 of these a year. When I go to companies, and I just did one to a bunch of chefs, actually, at a big cuisine company, and then I'm doing a big conference on Saturday at the DC Convention Center downtown, ASTD's annual meeting. When you expose people to these ratios, 3-1, 2-1, 1-1, and of course, I didn't even tell you the marital positive to the marriage. If you're married, it's 5-1. You need to have 5-1 positive to negative interactions if you're married.
Got to buy a lot of roses.
Yeah, buy a lot of roses. Yeah, you got to be really careful what you say. It's much better to be careful what you say than to make a goof and then have to sort of make that round up. So you find yourself holding your tongue more. I don't say things that I used to say. I'm pretty oral. I mean, as you can tell, I'll talk. But now I try to check what I say a little bit more that might be, biting and things like that. Because I realize now the damage that's doing. I didn't used to know what that was doing. I just thought it was like, oh, come on. I was just talking. No. This stuff does damage if you do it negatively. And it builds people if you do it positively. Kind of lost my train of thought there. But I think a lot of times people are unaware. They're unaware until they know these ratios. That was the point I was making. Once you hear these ratios, they kind of haunt you a little bit. I mean, gosh, with colleagues and people like that, you need to be really careful about being negative. And sometimes just asking questions is the way to go. It's the easier way to go, rather than pontificating. Ask people a lot of questions. Ask how, who, what kinds of questions. Act more like a coach. Be more curious, and you'll be surprised at how much more people will talk and actually solve their own problems. You don't really have to. you really don't have to solve people's problems.
Have you seen any transformations where somebody sort of realized, wow, I was a really negative leader before? Maybe they weren't willing to admit it.
Yeah, I don't know. I've had a conversation or two with people about being negative and what that's costing them. Yeah. And they're at least self-aware on it. And some people are. So here's the thing. I can tell you got to run, you got to be aerobic and eat and diet. Yeah. And you can understand it intellectually, but not be able to execute on it on a day-to-day basis. So sometimes people get it intellectually, but don't get it, don't execute on it. So what I tell people like that is, listen, even if you don't believe this stuff about the keeping the journal, fake it until you make it. By that I mean, try it. And just, like for example, they've done a lot of research on smiling. That smiling is the quickest way to get to know somebody and for somebody to like you. It's the quickest way to relate to people, right? And it's a very positive thing. And we see people who are smiling as being more successful. We see them as being more productive. We actually see them as being more intelligent. So what we tell people, if you're not used to smiling, practice smiling. Look at the mirror and just smile. Go out and smile at the first 10 people you meet. Just practice smiling. It sounds silly as hell. But you know what? After a while, it becomes very natural to you. You've met people who smile pretty naturally, and you're kind of a smiling kind of guy.
A happy, clappy guy.
Yeah. But I mean, that really has an effect on other people. It has an effect on your relationship with them. So what we tell people is, even if you don't believe it yet, fake it till you make it. If you just act through it, you'll actually begin to have it happen.
So folks just need to smile a little more.
I would say. They did a study out of in England, and a smile meant more than a number of boxes of chocolates to people. And in terms of its reward system, it meant more than thousands of dollars. It even had the same impact as an intimate relationship. So he said to people, all you got to do is smile, and 10 o'clock in the morning, you've had a box of chocolates, you've made some money, and you've had a good time, you know?
That's incredible.
Great way to start a day.
Well, I really appreciate all the time that you've spent here with us. Is there any sort of final takeaways or one piece of advice that you'd really like to leave folks with related to positive leadership?
Yeah, I would say if you're a leader, lead by example. People pick up, emotions are contagious. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, emotions are contagious. People will pick up on good emotions, they'll pick up on bad emotions. As a leader, if you want respect from other people, you have to give it to them first. It's a rule of reciprocity. If you want loyalty, you've got to be loyal to people first. It's not the other way around. Leaders have to lead. People want to be led, but they'll pick up whatever you're giving off. They'll pick up every emotion that you're giving off. We've gotten study after study that proves that about this emotional contagion. And so if you're going to be a good leader, if you're going to be a positive leader, if you want people to be positive working for you and have that sort of dynamic going, you've got to be positive yourself. You just have to, even days when I used to say to some guys, you got to play hurt sometimes. You got to, even when you're hurting, you got to work as closely to that as you possibly can. It's not easy. You don't do it all the time, but you have to work toward it. So lead by example. If you want it, then you got to give it.
Perfect. All right. Well, Steve Gladys, everybody. And what would be the best place for them to learn more about you? Would it be at your website?
Sure. Yeah. www.stevegladys.com or Amazon is where we have about, I think 19 books out there now.
Wow.
So there are, go to Amazon, just Google my, or just Amazon my name, and you'll find all the books out there.
Lots of helpful
books. And YouTube too. There's a lot of free stuff on YouTube that we've, I think 60 or 70 videos out there on explaining some of these books for free so that you can use them for training for free. I don't really care.
Perfect. Yeah. And we'll have information for you up on spiralmarketing.net as well. So
great.
Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Carl. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure having you.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Thinking back on the interview, there was a theme of leadership as a gift. Steve spoke very clearly towards the benefits of positive leadership. Putting his research to practice, I've been trying to supplement my beloved to-do list with his optimism profiles and list of three gratitudes. And the practice has been, well, positive. When asked for one thing of value from our meeting, Steve said he remembered why he wrote the book 20 years ago. Because of the two leaders he had, one good, the other bad. there's a kind of serendipity to leadership, and I don't mean that in a magic karma kind of serendipity, but more on the flip side of the phrase, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down, which is that opportunity tends to come to people willing to lead. Whether you are a creative, marketer, communicator, manager, or entrepreneur, I hope you found a lot of helpful takeaways from the show. To thank you for being so generous with your time and listening all the way to the end of the show, Steve and I would like to thank you with a free download of his Positive Leadership Matrix, which gives you an excellent framework for turning up the leadership positivity at spiralmarketing.net/get positive. That's spiralmarketing.net/get positive. Cheers.